is CBS Ireland World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Bob Zimmerman. He keeps the website Behind the Black. We're going to the most important star in the universe, the sun. Bob, a very good evening to you. We begin with the scientific inquiry of the sun, which I've taken over the years in all your reports. We don't know very much about. Have we learned more than we did yesterday? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Yes, using the European Space Agency's Solar Orbiter probe. This is a probe that's orbiting the sun closer than previously done. It's different than the Parker Solar Probe, which does deep dives very close, but only for short periods. Solar Orbiter goes in a wider orbit, but much closer than previously attempted, and therefore can study things from a closer distance, but a distance than other probes. And what scientists have done is, using its multiple instruments over a period of time, looking at various flare and coronal mass ejection events from the sun. These are eruptions off the sun's surface. What they've done is they've been able to track the very high energetic electrons that get flung from the sun during those eruptions. And what they've been able to do now is trace them back to the eruptions themselves and figure out why sometimes those electrons arrive at Earth, let's say, later than expected. They've actually now been able to trace out the path. I've got a great graphic on Behind the Black from the press release that shows this. When they come off a coronal mass ejection, they sometimes are the magnetic fields of the eruption guide the electrons around it, so that delays their arrival to Earth, and they bounce around as they do so. But they've now traced it back to both solar flares and coronal mass ejections in a much more precise manner, which means we just have a better understanding of what's going on. This is important for Earth technology, because a solar flare or CME, if it hits the Earth, could impact negatively our high-tech society, the electronics we use. And knowing it's coming helps protect the grid, helps engineers that run the grid protect it from these kind of events. So knowing how long it takes and why, they can better predict these things.
Bob, we have what is known as a yellow dwarf for a sun. And there are red dwarfs, there are all range of other stars. Is the presumption, and I know I'm asking a non-scientific question, I'm just asking logically, is the presumption that our star's functionality is similar to other stars' functionalities, or just within its class, a unique class?
The answer to that question is it's more complicated than you think. This is definitely a yellow G star, the sun, and that's part of a class, and it fits that class. But in trying to find solar twins of the sun so they can make comparisons, other stars, you know, if you can find a whole bunch of other stars that are just like the sun but of different ages, you can get a better feel for the sun's past and future behavior. The trouble they found is that, like every other object in the solar system, every G-type star is kind of unique, and the sun is unique in different ways. It appears to be less active than a lot of other G-stars, which suggests that over time it will become more active or has been more active. It's less variable than a lot of those G-type stars, once again suggesting that maybe it will be more variable at different times. They're all unique. Everything is unique. It's just the one takeaway that the space age has proven about objects in space. They're always very unique on their own self.
We're doing a flyby of Venus by JUICE. Remind what JUICE is, Bob.
JUICE is a European orbiter that is going to Jupiter. It's going to arrive 1 year after Europa Clipper. That's the NASA probe going to Jupiter. They're both going to orbit the planet, the gas giant, but both are focused on studying the big Galilean moons of Jupiter. Europa Clipper is focused mostly on Europa, but it'll look at the other Galilean moons. JUICE, it's an acronym. I don't pay attention to the acronyms. It's very stupid. It's silly, but it stands for the icy moons of Jupiter. That's Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. Those three specifically have a lot of ice on the surface, and it's going to fly by a lot and do that. Well, in order to get to Jupiter, it's got to do a bunch of flybys. This past week, it completed its only flyby of Venus. Getting just under 7,000 miles above the surface, that gives it some velocity. It will have to do two more flybys of Earth to gain even more velocity in order to reach Jupiter. It did no scientific investigations when it went by Venus because being closer to the sun, they used the high-gain antenna to protect its instruments. That meant it wasn't pointing towards Earth. They had contact from the medium-gain antenna, but not enough to do any research, and the instruments were blocked anyway. So it's in good shape. It had problems earlier this summer, but they got those fixed, and it's on its way.
I love everything about Mars, and now we're going to its interior. You use the adjective chaotic. How so, Bob?
All right, well, we have to do this in comparison to the Earth. Remember, every object's unique. The Earth's in a structure is very layered. We have a mantle, then we have a layer under that, and you have another layer, and then you have the core at the bottom. It's very coherently layered. It appears that the mantle of Mars, based on the seismic data that was obtained by InSight, the lander, is not layered as evenly. The mantle is, in fact, a lot of broken up pieces, very chaotic. That's at least what this seismic data suggests. The theory is that this broken up mantle is the result of the early planet's formation during the heavy bombardment about, what is it, a half a billion years ago. Lots of big objects were hitting the planet as it accreted into a planet, but in the process it broke the mantle up. And because Mars's gravity isn't as great as Earth, it's only about 39%, it didn't become coherently layered again afterward. That's the theory. As I always point out, there's a lot of uncertainties here. We've only had one seismometer on the planet, only for a short period of time. We're going to need more data before we really have this firmly in place, John.
Before we leave Mars, I remember reading that Mars might be a protoplanet, the core of a planet that never got built entirely? Is that another planet in the solar system?
Yeah, I think you're confusing that, John, with Vesta, the asteroid Vesta.
I see.
Which has layered components, but it's small. And you wouldn't get layered interior without a lot of gravity. So they assume that we're looking at a broken up planet, pieces of a planet that doesn't exist anymore. In the case of Mars, it's a real planet. It's just smaller than Earth and has, once again, a unique, different history than ours.
All right, we go to glaciers on Mars. You spent a lot of time studying glaciers, Bob. What do we learn from them?
The key here is understanding what Mars is about. And until the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and the Mars Express Orbiter from Europe were orbiting the planet over the last decade, we were not sure whether Mars was a desert, dry, or what. We didn't really know the details. And what those orbiters have confirmed without doubt is that Mars is not a dry desert like the Sahara. And I've said this many times, and unfortunately a lot of press people don't get it. It is like Antarctica. It's dry in that it doesn't snow. It does snow, but that's a different story. It doesn't have liquid water, but above 30 degrees latitude, there is pretty much near-surface ice almost anywhere. And in large regions in the mid-latitudes, there are glaciers everywhere. And the geology is fascinating, and it's unique. I have a what-the-heck image that I found from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter showing glacial features in the northern mid-latitudes. And these are glaciers from all the data, but they're strange. They're very strange. And I don't tell me to explain what they look like, but I put the picture up because it's incredibly cool, and it just proves, once again, Mars is alien.
Are there caves or underground chambers that I'm looking at when I look at that glacier?
No, we don't know of anything like that. And think of glaciers on Earth in this case. You might get cracks, and you might get openings, but generally you're looking at solid flows. You know, this is not a cave environment.
I'm not complaining. The abundance of water makes Mars extremely attractive for a colony.
Oh, yes. That's one thing. Once again, I go crazy because most press people don't know this, and too many scientists don't recognize what we've learned, that Mars has ample near-surface ice above 30 degrees latitude. If you don't land in the dry tropics, you're going to have access to water pretty easily.
Which means that you can sustain something living for quite some period of time. All right. Now we go to Perseverance, which is one of our landing probes. And Bob puts up these pictures to remind me this is not Earth. I always.
Yes, yes. Perseverance is one of the two active rovers on Mars. Curiosity is the other. And it is exploring the exterior rim of Jezero Crater. It has been now for several months. And so it took a great picture looking west away from the crater, and I posted it because you could see the tracks of the rover where it had been. You could see the features it had been studying. You could see the mountains in the distance, and you could see the utter barrenness of the terrain. You know, there's NASA likes to lie and say Perseverance's mission is to find life. It's an utter lie. They're studying the geology because every scientist knows the likelihood of their life being here is almost nil. It's a barren world. It's ripe for humans to bring life to it. We can do that eventually, but it is basically a lifeless world right now.
You've got a map of overhead of where Perseverance is. Where is it headed? Where is it going?
The red dots on that map show the planned route, and they have only released data to a certain point, mainly working on the exterior rim. I had always expected, and they had always said they were going to head out to the west because that's a region that has a lot of evidence of minerals, making it a potentially very valuable mining region. And I always expected to head west away from the crater, but they haven't done so yet.
And that route behind it, that's the climb that it's made.
Yes, the white dotted line on my map is what it has done, and the red dotted line shows what they planned. And it's been moving back and forth, actually, on the exterior rim now for a long time, sometimes retreating where it had been, because they're trying to find places they can drill to get core samples, and they've had some trouble doing that.
An exoplanet that looks to fit the theory of where planets come from inside a disk surrounding a star. Explain what we're looking at, Bob.
Yes, this is a great image produced by Webb and the ALMA telescope in Chile. It's the first exoplanet that has actually been detected in the gap of the accretion disk. The theory is that as planets accrete, they will start to sweep out the region where they're orbiting and create a gap in the accretion disk. That's the theory. This is the a clear detection of an exoplanet inside that disk. It's the first since 2018 that we've seen a planet inside an accretion disk, but it's the first one we've seen in a gap. And the picture shows that very clearly. In fact, it shows there's at least two other gaps in the ring, suggesting other exoplanets are also there, though we can't see them yet. And this is a sun-like star, John. Once again, it's not exactly like the sun, but it's very close to the sun. So we're actually looking at a solar system forming that could someday be very similar to ours. Or not? It's a very interesting question. One of the things about this discovery that's it's challenges theories, because the theories have been that this is a Jupiter-sized planet, by the way, that they've discovered. The theory is that these planets can form far out and then migrate inward so they'd be where the orbit of Jupiter is. Well, this formed far out, but it stayed far out. That's why the gap's there, which says that this migration theory might not be right. In other words, we don't know enough yet to make any real theory about planetary formations or solar system formations.
All right, I'm going to be a simple-minded amateur here. We're looking at a planet 435 light years from us. It's amazing, Bob. We can.
Yes. Yes. There's no question the technology of astronomy has gotten pretty amazing. No doubt about it.
A baby star and its protoplanetary disk. This is much the same direction, but there's no planet visible yet.
No, we looked, unlike the previous picture, which looked kind of down the face of the star. It was a little oblique, but it was looking down the face, so we saw the disk. This is looking along the ecliptic, so you see the disk as a line across the star of dust. But above and below it is this beautiful cone of glowing nebula material. And what's happening with this baby star is that the disk was originally a sphere. That's what it always starts out as a sphere. The star forms, and what happens is the thing spins. The material above and below the disk gets sucked down into the disk. And so that's what these cones are. The material is slowly being spiraled down into the disk to form the accretion disk that will eventually potentially form planets. And it's a great web into, infrared image that I posted because of the beauty of it.
Bob Zimmerman. He keeps the website Beyond the Blast, quote, black. When we come back, a little politics in space, for space.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.